But let's start with Iraj. Iraj is a Iranian-born, Iranian-schooled, but South African partly, I guess, taught, and of course, a South African gem. So he's got the Iranian background. He came here. He was at UCT. He was professor of economics at the University of Cape Town, when that really meant something. Then he moved on to the government, where he played a huge role in things like the RDP white paper, GEAR, the medium-term expenditure framework. Remember that thing that Trevor Manuel, it used to be called the mini-budget to begin with, and then they got all grumpy about it. Now we're not allowed to call it the mini-budget anymore, but it's the midway session for the budgets, between budgets. Because what used to happen in this country was every March, you would have the budget speech, and there'd be all kinds of insider trading up to the budget speech, because the politicians, you know, they don't really know the value of price-sensitive information, or maybe they did. But the fact was, you would see different share prices moving, and Trevor didn't like that. He didn't like that at all, for good reason. And so what he did was he introduced, with the help of people like Iraj, the medium-term expenditure framework, where they actually worked it out over 3 years, a budget over 3 years, and then every 6 months, the medium-term expenditure framework came out around about October, and then you didn't have this all this price-sensitive information that was throwing around there. And then after that, after government, Iraj worked at Standard Bank as the chief economist and had a unique insight into the way the country worked, both from academia and from inside government. And thereafter, he has been an entrepreneur running his own company, which is one of the most respected independent operations to do with economics and policy, Pan-African Investment and Research Services. It's been a real privilege to engage with Iraj on that other stuff, but my goodness, since Iran came to the global focus, what a privilege to have this man in our country who could speak out and speak independently about things that now affect us every day. Because when you go and fill up your tank, it's related to what's happening in the Middle East and the Straits of Hormuz. The last time we spoke to, or Iraj spoke to the BizNews conference, there was enormous interest internationally, as well as locally, of course, on what he had to say. I've no doubt this will be exactly the same case, because we're all pretty much confused. Even as you heard from Simon Baloyi this morning, he gets up in the morning and sees, now what the hell has Trump done today? My words, not his. Let's welcome Iraj Abedian.
This BizNews production is brought to you by Brenthurst Wealth, the leader in offshore investing, connecting South Africa to opportunities worldwide. Invest better with Brenthurst.
Thank you very much, Alex, for those kind words, and thank you very much for the opportunity again. As you heard, I come from a bit of a background in academia, so I have to double check everything that I'm going to say. So I've written, but a few minutes ago I thought it might be better if I don't read, but rather discuss the story of the Chuane-Tehran or Tehran-Chuane axis. The story begins, this axis begins in 1941. The then Shah of Iran, remember it's the Second World War, Stalin invades Iran from north, Churchill invades Iran from the south. Now you've heard of the Strait of Hormuz, so you know where it is. And the Shah of Iran at that time, within 3 weeks, abdicates. The British forces put him under arrest, send him to Mauritius. He was seen as an ally of Hitler. So Hitler decided, or had planned, according to the British forces, to kidnap him from Mauritius. So Britain brought him to Johannesburg, put him under arrest. under the British forces. Number 41, Yonge Street, Houghton Street, still there. So the story begins, the relationship dates back to that time. And interesting things happen in between. I'm going to as fast as I can. And the story that I'm going to share with you the best I can within the 20 minutes that I have, think of it as an onion, if you like. If you don't like, think of it as concentric circles. And I'm going to unpack each of these circles, and then we can have a discussion. So Reza Shah comes to Johannesburg under arrest. His family comes here. Americans and the Second World War happens. Russians don't leave Iran, or didn't want to leave Iran, take about 30-40% of the land after all. And then the British have to contend with the Russians, and then they get into a cahoot with Americans. 1953, about 8 years after the Second World War, CIA stages a coup d'etat in Iran, brings back the son of the Shah, who was in exile. Of course, he himself died in 1944 in Johannesburg. His son gets reinstated as then the Shah of Iran. So the American and Iranian culture or political engagement begins on a wrong footing. Because in 1953, the nationalist movement wanted and had worked hard for 28 years to establish a democratic constitutional monarchy in Iran. CIA wanted it an autocratic, fully powered, with the commitment that it will become constitutional, which never happened. So some of the root causes of what's happening now as we speak in the Middle East and between America and the United States, not between America and the Islamic Republic's regime, but between America and the Iranian, the Persian nation, intellectuals and nationalists, dates back to 1953, which has not yet been forgotten, and I don't think will ever be forgotten. When the Shah gets reinstated, he remembers Johannesburg, he remembers his family, he remembers in particular General Fraser, who took care of the family. So he insists that if there is going to be a relationship between Iran and South Africa, General Fraser has to be representing South Africa. So General Fraser gets positioned or commissioned or appointed to as the general counsel, because it wasn't an embassy, it never became an embassy. But he was a very personal friend, not a diplomatic, political relationship between the Shah and the representative of the South African government. 1960s happens and 1970s, OPEC happens. The Shah of Iran at that time was on a fast-track secularization, industrialization, diversification, everything that the country, in his view, needed. And South Africa became an interesting potential technology partner. And OPEC had been formed, and South Africa became an interesting side distribution channel for the Iranian oil. So a deal was struck at the time that Sasol was being also conceptualized technologically. And I don't know if Mr. Bellow is here. He might be interested in some of the details, that the Shah of Iran took 70% equity stake on behalf of the nation, of course, not in his personal capacity, in exchange for another channel of distribution, in exchange for building and investing in Saldana oil reserve structures that are still being used. And the relationship became better and better from an economic theory and trade theory point of view. The Iranian economy and the South African economy were perfect match. What this one had, the other one didn't have, and vice versa. So that worked perfectly well. 1979 comes, the revolution, as I mentioned in my previous, and of course it's a fact of history, was brought in by Carter and his crowd, and the Shah was toppled. Khomeini was brought in, the Islamic Republic, within 3 months, stated two important objectives, declared war on America as the great Satan, and Israel as the minor Satan, representative of the great Satan in the Middle East. The embassy or the consulate general was put under the Swiss Office of Interest, and the new regime, having declared the United States as the dominant imperialist against the oppressed nation of the people, amongst the oppressed people, two groups were identified as top priority: people of Palestine, the Zionist State of Israel, and the black South Africans oppressed. So an immediate alliance was held, at least theoretically or philosophically or politically, between the Islamic Republic and the anti-apartheid movements in South Africa. 1992, when the then released Nelson Mandela, at that time, one of the early or one of the very few international visits that he did, he was in Tehran to thank the Islamic Republic leaders for the support that they had received. Because prior to that, in 1980, Iraq, with the support of the United States and France, invaded Iran. South Africa at that time was supporting Saddam Hussein, giving them special guns and weapons. And that cemented, in a way, the relationship even further, so that by 1992, when Mandela was released, he felt that he should go to Tehran, and he did. And of course, when he was president, subsequently, he never went to Iran. In a year after his term, in 1999, he, by that time, as a peace laureate, went to Tehran for a different mission. He went to promote the Oslo pact that had been negotiated for a two-state solution in Israel, or between Israel and Palestinians. And he did a great deal of work both in Tehran and in Tel Aviv, in both of them, and met Yasser Arafat, who was a very personal friend. So the relationship cemented around different routes. That is the beginning of the relationship. But of course, during President Mbeki and subsequently, the relationship became a fairly regular diplomatic relationship, because there was good, and still remains, very good commercial, economic, theoretic relationship between these two countries. So hold that. That's the first circle. The second circle, I'm watching the time. You have no doubt followed what President Trump decided to do after many, many successive presidents, knowing in the United States, never dared to do it. I mentioned in my previous inputs, and many others have said, that he had a historic moment to change the world order in a very different way in the Middle East. Of course, I also expressed that he was extremely naive and gung-ho and simplistic about it. As we speak, and over the past 7 months, the United States has increasingly got himself like into a swamp, sinking from one mistake to another. His biggest mistake, which has caused him the stalemate that he has now, in around April, 5 weeks into the battle that he thought was only going to take 6 weeks, and only God alone knows how simplistic do you have to be to think that you could dislodge, or as he wanted to do, and many of his advisors, they said, no, it's a question of surrender. We'll bomb the hell out of them. We'll destroy their leadership. And much what we did to Japan, the emperor will surrender. And they had produced a submission document for signature in Mr. Trump's imagination, which he still holds. Only early June, as military confrontation became so brutal, possibly unprecedented, over 20, in terms of the statistics released by both Israelis and US, 27,000 locations have been bombed in Iran. Can you imagine the damage that is done to the economy? They have killed the top 77 of the Islamic Republic regime, beginning in the first minute with Ayatollah Khomeini himself. But their assumption that by killing, as Netanyahu often has said, that the head of the octopus is in Tehran and we must cut it. Their assumption was that cutting the head will force the rest of the system to implode and to submit. And they'll sign the submission, and thereafter they can do what similarly they thought they'd done in Venezuela. That was a fundamental false assumption, and I don't have time to go into details of it. The reality is that they are stuck, and that the chessboard of the Middle East is being shaped literally hourly. Things have changed so much so that despite dramatic and Hollywood style of military, especially air superiority of Americans, bombing everything that they could identify and everything that Mossad and others have identified, still, according to the CIA reports, which I think is as good as it can get in terms of matching it with what I get from internal sources, still 70% of the Iranian missiles are untouched. And still the Iranian system, not the Iranian people, who are suffering tremendously. The system had prepared itself for 30 years for this confrontation. It had created not an octopus, but a network of resistance, as they call it. And you can see it literally on a daily basis, so much so that the American bases are now rolling back from the Middle East. The whole security of the region, remember that this is 40-odd% of the oil reserves globally. And in terms of daily flows, it's about 30%. But in terms of world economy, it's absolutely the choke point. Many mistakes have been made. I'm not a military analyst, but from basic common sense and from based on what I had been following for years from both sides, which was not secret stuff. But everybody ignored the obvious stuff, and they went into this fairly imaginary world of receiving a surrender letter from the regime. But be as it may, that's the second circle of event that we're looking at. They have pushed each other to the brink. The personality of Trump and his divided cabinet does not accept defeat. But this is the moment in my personal understanding of the evolution of the historic political economy of the past century, that this is the moment that historians will define as the first sign of the collapse of the American empire, much like what happened to the British empire. It won't be easy, it won't be quick, but it has begun, and the rollback of the American military base presence in the Middle East and the rejigging of the chessboard of security for the Middle East entirely and going all the way to India on the one hand and north of Africa on the other with massive global implications is being drawn up as we speak. Even an hour ago that I was double-checking the latest development, Pakistan is trying desperately on behalf of Saudi Arabia and so on to bring something together. Both of them refuse because the surrender letter that President Trump has put to the Iranians is not acceptable, will not be accepted, nor the surrender letter that Iranians or IRGC has put to Trump is acceptable, which in brief says, get home, roll back your bases from and leave the region to regional powers. You can understand. Of course, there is a third circle, and I've got 4 minutes very briefly. The third circle is the historic dominant trend of changing world order. China is involved. Russia has been involved, as I mentioned, since 1941. And local players such as, obviously, Israel has got existential threat, is involved. Turkey is involved. Saudi Arabia is involved. Pakistan is involved. And Egypt and India on the peripheries. But these global chessboard is subject to what I call it epochal transformation. It is not a short-term thing. It is about the changing world order that we see it in our neighborhood, in our national, in our region, and international level. Institutions are losing credibility from local government to national, to regional, to institutions of the United Nations and others. So that is the disintegrative force that is happening. But at the same time, in every region, in every neighborhood, in every country, including Iran, including Israel, including the United States, there are integrative forces that want to bring collaboration together. They want to make sure that through being together, we grow faster, better, and more prosperous. These are massive historic forces at play. And we have a situation that within these two governments, governments of Trump or administrations of President Trump, administrations in the ruling regime in Iran, each of them is a split three ways. So we see this integrative force and disintegrative force even within these two administrations that are enemies of each other. One group says, bomb the hell out of them, remove them, kill them, you cannot live with them. Make America great. The other one says, make Islamic civilization a reality. This is our moment in history, that we've got the largest, the most dominant and powerful superpower by its neck, and we must suffocate them at all costs, even if it means 1 million, 2 million, 3 million, 10 million, 20 million more have to die. Push them out, because we'll never get them again. I'm not making up these things. I can give you, for those of you who understand language, I can give you clips from the top of these powers. The same way that in the cabinet of, or in the administration of Trump, there are equally people who say, we never have this opportunity again. Kill the snake once and for all, no matter what the cost. And within the same cabinet and within the same administration, there are people who say, this is not going to work. Let's make peace, let's talk, and let's find a way and get whoever have to get involved. That's a better outcome. And there are those who are sitting on the fence watching what things are. To wrap it up, and I'm sure there's a lot of details here that I cannot have time. As we see it, the global economy is held hostage to these two disintegrative forces. One cannot countenance, President Trump cannot countenance failure, cannot sign and say, I'll go home, I made a mistake, sorry. And the other, for personal or for the or from the perspective of a dominant superpower. At the other end, within the Islamic Republic, there are those ideologues who have a religious mission. They have a belief that their ultimate aim of being in power, having used what they have, having built what they have built, is for the moment of martyrdom on the way of their God-given purpose. And at the other end, on the north part, there are equally committed religious groups in Israel who say, our mission, going back thousands of years, is to protect this holy land. So we are now stuck, and the global economy is stuck, in this quagmire of this transformational epochal change of order in the globe, with changes in human psyche and consciousness at the same time. I'll stop here and then we can take. Thank you very much.
This BizNews production is brought to you by Brenthurst Wealth, building wealth and protecting legacy since 2004. Invest better with Brenthurst. Start your day a step ahead. BizNews Insider. It delivers the business stories that matter every morning straight to your inbox, sharp, fast, and free. Subscribe now.